there at notes. Let me get this. There it notes that the Christian community is founded on the love of Christ, who by his cross tore down the wall of separation and made all one people. That's the word of the cross. Jesus on his cross tore down all that separates, all that divides, and made all one people. So the word of the cross is a word of reconciliation and healing. The word of the cross is a word of restoration and peace. The word of the cross is about overcoming divisions and estrangement, animosity and conflict. It is about making one all that has been torn apart. Now, if we stop and reflect, so many things in our world are being torn apart today. Families are being torn apart. Friendships are torn apart. Communities are torn apart. Society is torn apart. All we have to do is open our eyes, and what we see is that forces of division abound. We see that powerfully and tragically in the war in the Middle East now, in the ongoing war in Ukraine. But we see those forces of division abundantly at work throughout our world. The cross reveals that human beings are very good at fostering factions and divisions. Human beings are very good at breakdowns in justice and breakdowns in love. We're very good at tearing things apart. But the cross pushes back. The cross pushes back because the power of the cross is the power to heal. The power of the cross is the power to mend and to reconcile, the power to make whole. The passion and death of Jesus testify that God is at work in the world. God is not on the sidelines. God is at work in the world, and God is at work in the world, moving things to wholeness and fullness of life. That's the momentum of the Spirit, moving things toward wholeness and fullness of life. Because our charism is to preach the word of the cross in season and out of season, Passionists have a special role in furthering God's work to make things whole. The Passionist charism compels us to become channels of God's healing love, channels for overcoming division and polarization, by being channels of reconciliation, healing, and life. Every Passionist is called to make things whole. So I want to turn now to three ways that we can live out that calling. First, we must learn to speak, to communicate. The prologue of the Gospel of John says, "In the beginning was the Word." In the beginning, God speaks to us. God communicates. And the word God speaks to us is Jesus. But God speaks the word that is Jesus, not only to communicate with us, but to show us how we are called to come to life by communicating with one another in a Christ-like way, in our words and in our actions. We are given life to communicate, and we come more fully to life the deeper we do communicate. But of course, this means that breakdowns in communication, refusing to communicate, or not even trying, diminishes all of us. That's why we can't stay stuck in polarization and division, no matter how tempting that is. If we are given life to communicate with one another, to encounter one another, not to do so, to give up trying, diminishes all of us. Now, there's an English theologian and pastor, Samuel Wells, who suggests that this opening sentence to the Gospel of John means that communication, the desire to share and relate, the urge to engage and to listen, to receive and to open up, is the very core of all things. Indeed, the reason for the creation of all things. Wells says that human beings are created to share, to encounter, to open ourselves to others, and to receive others into our life. We are created not for alienation and estrangement, but to be an ever-deepening relationship. However, that is only possible when we grow in our ability and willingness to share and to relate, to interact, and through that interaction, to draw continually closer to one another. Through that communication and that encounter, to overcome isolation and loneliness through love. That's the challenge. Discord and division only results in isolation and loneliness. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word that was spoken was love. We are called to make that Word our own. So what I want to suggest tonight sounds so simple, but it's so challenging. The only power that's stronger than discord and alienation and everything that's driving us apart is the power of love, because love is always a power for healing and unity. So when there are constant breakdowns in communication, or when we just stop trying, or when we simply do not bother to love, we deny ourselves the very thing we need to have a truly human existence. We are created for community. We're created for relationship, for fellowship. And that means the only way to a truly good human life is through the kind of communication that makes genuine, life-giving relationships and community possible. There's no other path to life. That is why when polarization and division and animosity prevail, everybody loses. There's no winners in that game. When polarization, discord, and animosity prevails, everybody loses, because then all we have in common is our collective misery and our crushing loneliness. Why? Because we're not bothering to love. In that same short article, Samuel Wells goes on to note that the word not only was spoken to us, but became flesh and lived among us. What Jesus teaches us, Wells suggests, is that the whole purpose of our existence is to communicate fully with one another and to communicate back with God. That's the heart of the matter. The whole purpose of our existence is to communicate fully with one another and to communicate back with God. To fail to do so is to live at odds with the deepest truth of our nature. But isn't that precisely what is happening all around us? The shouting, the anger, the discord and animosity, the wars and the violence, the factions, the polarization, testify that we've lost the ability to communicate. We've lost that ability, and it's killing us, because we are denying ourselves the very thing that we need to live. So this is why we need to look at the cross. This is why the call to contemplate Christ's passion and to keep alive the memory of the passion of Christ is so crucial today. When we look at the cross, what do we see? Samuel Wells says that in the cross, Jesus's nonviolent communication of love meets the world's violence, and for a moment, violence prevails. When we contemplate the cross, what do we see? Jesus's nonviolent communication of love meets the world's violence, and for a moment, violence prevails. But the cross and the resurrection testify, Wells concludes, that Christianity is finally a story in which communication prevails over violence. That's our hope. The passion of Jesus tells us that, yes, we live in a crucifying world. The evidence for that is all about around us. We live in a crucifying world because when Jesus's message of nonviolent love meets the world's violence, for a moment, violence prevails. but the cross and resurrection disclose that violence and hatred and discord do not have the last word. They do not triumph. In the end, love wins out over violence. In the end, love wins out over violence. I think what the world desperately needs to see today is a story which communicates that in the end, love wins out over violence. If that's the case, how do we once again learn to speak so that we can tell that story? I want to suggest two virtues, each of which were highlighted in the passage from Ephesians, which we began this evening, and each of which flows from the Passionist Charism, the virtue of gentleness and the virtue of humility. In her novel, Evensong, the writer Gail Godwin describes the Eucharist as eternal companionship. That's such a beautiful image, to speak of the Eucharist as eternal companionship. It speaks to us, it touches us, because that's the deepest longing of our lives, that longing for companionship, that longing for love and friendship, for intimacy. We're created for those things, love, friendship, and companionship, not for discord, not for division. We hunger for eternal companionship. And no matter how often we fall short, that's the deepest longing of our lives. But that will only happen when we cultivate certain virtues. A virtue is a characteristic way of being and acting that makes both who we are and what we do good. A virtue helps us flourish and prosper, not only as individuals, but also as communities. Simply put, virtues enable us to live wisely and well. Gentleness is a virtue that enables everyone to live wisely and well, particularly in an age of discord and division. Because gentleness, Thomas Aquinas said, gentleness restrains anger. Now, we may think of gentleness as softness or weakness, but Aquinas reminds us that like any virtue, gentleness is a strength. Like any virtue, gentleness is a power for excellence. Gentleness's special strength is to protect us from the dangers of excessive anger that contribute to polarization and division. I don't know about you, but I've never heard anyone say that gentleness was at the top of their list of the most important virtues. It's never happened in my life. I don't think it ever will. But at a time when so many conversations break down because of anger, gentleness seems especially important. Think of how often today people describe themselves as enraged. There are things we should be enraged about, but to be continuously enraged over differences of opinion, over political philosophies or other ideologies, over little inconveniences and irritations, makes life together impossible. Think of all the times we've seen people yelling and screaming at one another, rather than really listening and communicating. It wears everyone out. It exhausts all of us, and it gets us nowhere. Think of the angry letters people write, or the angry emails, or the angry exchanges on social media. Think about what those letters, emails, and messages do to people who receive them. At those moments, a dose of gentleness would make a world of difference, because gentleness restrains anger. And when gentleness restrains anger, we're much more likely not to act on impulse, much more likely not to say or do things that cause harm, that deeply hurt people, and further weaken our communities and society. What I'm suggesting that extreme anger is dangerous. When Aquinas was writing about the dangers of anger, he mentioned three things. He said, out of control anger increases bitterness and vindictiveness. It doesn't bring me peace. If it's out of control, I want to get back. I want to hurt. Secondly, he said, out of control anger clouds our judgment. When I'm possessed by anger, I'm not thinking clearly. I'm not seeing clearly. Third, he said, out of control anger makes it much more likely that we will want to be cruel and mean and not be bothered by it. That's a dangerous state to be in, to be cruel and thoughtless and mean and not really to care. One of the reasons that polarization and discord run rampant right now is that everyday acts of excessive anger that lead to cruelty, meanness, and thoughtlessness have become so common. We're accustomed to them. They no longer surprise us. But as members of the Passionist family, we are called to witness something better. We are called to push back. To push back against these toxic forces of division by cultivating gentleness. We need in our lives together and in our ministries to promote gentleness. We need to make gentleness a high priority. We need to exemplify gentleness in our conversations with others and how we talk both about and to one another and in how we treat one another. And I think we should preach about the importance of gentleness in our retreat centers, parishes, and on itinerant missions. Why? Because with gentleness, we're not so quick to judge, not so quick to retaliate. Without gentleness, we cannot possibly live the story in which communication and love prevail over violence. Now, I'm obviously I'm pushing gentleness hard here tonight, because I think it's really important here for finding our way out of the mess in which we're stuck. I think it would be great on a retreat, on a parish mission, to have a talk on overlooked and forgotten virtues. And you could start with gentleness, because we don't live in a culture today that encourages us to be gentle. Just the opposite. It encourages self-assertion, always winning, always getting our way. Gentleness counteracts that. A second virtue that can help us here is the virtue of humility. Now, sometimes people get pretty edgy or squeamish anytime you mention humility. And maybe that's because we can confuse genuine humility from counterfeit versions of humility. Humility is not poor self-esteem. It is not an unhealthy lack of confidence. And humility should never be equated with self-loathing or self-depreciation. It should never be identified with unhealthy submission and lack of self-regard. Those are not virtues, but a tragic failure to follow Jesus' command to love and care for ourselves, to value ourselves as people who are unconditionally loved and cherished by God. As the theologian Richard Guler wrote, humility is not low self-esteem, but low self-preoccupation. Or as C.S. Lewis noted, humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. So how then can we speak of humility? Humility is clarity of vision about ourself and our place in the world. It's a clarity of vision about ourself and our place in the world that enables us to recognize what really matters. Humility is an honest appreciation of ourselves that allows us to honestly appreciate and esteem others. That's what's missing today. That ability to honestly appreciate and esteem others, especially those who are different from us. With humility, because we see ourselves clearly and accept who we are with our gifts and our talents, our successes and our achievements, but also our weaknesses, our limits, our shortcomings, our failures. Because of that, we can appreciate and accept others who, like us, have many gifts and talents and successes and achievements, but also, like us, have weaknesses, limits, shortcomings, and failures. When we see ourselves clearly and accept who we are, which is the power of humility, we aren't threatened by the gifts and achievements of others, but rather are grateful for them. Humility enables us to be a friend and companion rather than a competitor or worse, an adversary. That's the kind of change that has to happen. The problem at the root of so much division is that we see everybody who disagrees with us as an enemy. Humility enables us to be a friend and a companion. So if we're created to encounter, to be open to others, to be in relationship, none of that is possible without humility. Humility is the openness and vulnerability that enables us to be blessed by another's love. I want to say that again because I think this is so key. Humility is the openness and vulnerability that enables us to be blessed by another's love. That openness and vulnerability is essential if we are to witness a story in which love prevails over discord and violence. Humble people have richer lives because they are not afraid to let other people into them. They want to share and engage. They want to open up and receive because they know that we come more fully to life, not by closing our lives off to others, especially those who may be very different from ourselves, but by opening up to them, by making space for them. Humble people have richer, better lives because they let themselves be blessed by another's love. When polarization and division prevails, that cannot happen. When we're that divided, we cannot be blessed by another's love, and that's what we need to live. Now, I was thinking today, this might seem like a very ordinary example, but we speak so often the last few years about the Passionist family. And it struck me that that Passionist family, avowed and lay Passionists coming together, could not happen without humility. It could only happen when we were able to appreciate each person's giftedness, each person's unique blessing, each person's unique contribution. That coming together as Passionist family is built on a foundation of humility. So humility is a counterforce to polarization, a counterforce to all the shouting matches that exhaust us, because humble people are not afraid to admit that they don't know everything. Humble people are eager to listen and learn from others, eager to consult and confer, eager to be open to another person's ideas and suggestions, because they are not hesitant to admit that maybe those ideas and suggestions might be better than their own. Humility leads to better relationships, better communities, better churches, better societies, because it teaches us not to be so quick to judge, not to be so quick to criticize or condemn. Instead of immediately dismissing an idea or opinion we disagree with, humility inclines us to look for whatever truth it might hold. Not to immediately say this person is wrong, but to look for whatever truth might be in what they're saying. And instead of ridiculing or denigrating a person with whom we disagree, humility is the graciousness of spirit by which we try to understand them. Humility shapes our character so that we assume the best of others, interpret what they say in the best possible light, and regularly give them the benefit of the doubt. With humility, instead of jumping to conclusions about people, deriding or condemning them, we envision them graciously, and we do our best to think well of them. With humility, I may disagree with you, but I still see a person who has good in them, a person whose life blesses me. And I think one of the reasons that Passionist ministries are so effective with people is because of that. So many Passionists, both lay and vowed, that I've known over the years have exhibited that characteristic in their life. They may not always disagree with you, but they still see a person who has good in them, a person whose life blesses me. Now, when he was writing about the virtue of humility, St. Thomas Aquinas said that humility curbs pushiness. Now, that's a great insight, and it makes me laugh because we don't like to think of ourselves as pushy people. But Aquinas says it's pretty easy for us to be pushy. We like getting our way. We tend to think my ideas are the best. Sometimes we would rather prevail than cooperate. We're pushy. This can happen in friendships. It can happen in marriages and families. It can happen in community life, in our parishes, and certainly in the larger society. Now, Thomas Aquinas had those insights in the 13th century, but they hold our attention because they offer such an accurate analysis of what besets us today. Part of the reason there is so much polarization and division is that we become pushy. In fact, we live in a society that encourages pushiness, even celebrates it. We're pushy when it's our way or no way. We're pushy when we take our group, our political party, our ideas, our priorities, and even our theologies far too seriously. Aquinas said, pride fuels pushiness. But the pride that fuels pushiness, he said, results not only in looking down on others, but even more, having contempt for them. Think of how the rhetoric of contempt is so strong in our political discourse, on social media, and sometimes even in the church. Pride is at the bottom of pushiness, but pride leads to contempt. And contempt is always going to be toxic to any kind of communication and community living. I want to turn briefly to a second way to learn to deal with difference. So we've talked about learning to communicate and focused on humility and gentleness as virtues that can help us do that. A second way to learn to deal with difference is by learning to see. Now, this sounds strange because we can think that seeing well comes naturally to us, or that all we have to see to do to see is simply to open our eyes. But as the late philosopher and novelist Iris Murdoch continually stressed, we can open our eyes and fail to see what we need to see. We don't typically hear a lot about vision in the Christian life, but learning to see well, learning to see justly, truthfully, lovingly, and reverently makes all the difference, because how we act in a situation depends on how we see it. How we act in a situation depends on how we see it. So there's a really tight connection between vision and virtue. That's because we cannot act rightly unless we first see rightly. For example, if we look at the world through eyes of pride and anger, through eyes of entitlement and arrogance, our behavior is bound to do harm because we see everything in terms of our own needs and preferences. We bend the world to ourselves, which is how Iris Murdoch described fantasy. To fantasize, Murdoch says, is not to see clearly. It's to bend the world to ourselves. In a world of fantasy, our actions lack compassion. They lack kindness, justice, and love. Because in a world of fantasy, we cannot see the image of God in others, much less the inherent goodness and beauty in all of life. Every expression of injustice, whether it's economic justice, racial injustice, the injustice that comes from sexism, the injustice that's enacted toward the LGBTQ community, the environmental injustice, injustice towards people with physical, mental, or emotional disabilities, every act of injustice is rooted in a failure of vision, rooted in an inability or refusal to see the God-given dignity and goodness of another human being, of another creature, of the natural world and to act on it. Piers Murdoch wrote, "I can only choose within the world I can see." And that's the problem. We can only choose within the world we can see. But oftentimes we do not see things as they really are, but as we need them to be. Instead of reverencing another person precisely in his or her differences and beholding them as a precious child of God, we fantasize. We twist everything to meet our needs. Our vision is clouded by self-interest, clouded by anxiety, fear, and self-deception. And it's not just that I cannot see as I need to see, but that very often I do not want to see as I need to see. I prefer self-deception over the truth. I prefer comforting illusions over a much more challenging reality, namely the challenging reality to love. Murdoch also spoke of fantasy as the proliferation of blinding self-centered aims and images. I think part of the reason there is so much polarization and division in our society today is that too many people prefer fantasy to the truth. In a world of blinding self-centered aims and images, regard for what is true and real, regard for what is genuinely good, genuinely just and loving and worthwhile, fades away. In a world of fantasy, I surround myself with people who think like I do, people who will endorse rather than challenge my biases and assumptions. In other words, in a world of fantasy, there is never community, but only the self. In the world of fantasy, there is never community. There's only the self, because I bend everything to my own needs. The problem with fantasy is that with fantasy, we'll never learn to deal with difference in a way that is constructive and hopeful, loving and just. This is why Murdoch says our basic moral challenge is to pierce the veil of selfishness in order to see justly, lovingly, truthfully, and reverently. Our basic moral challenge is to pierce the veil of selfishness, to break free from fantasy so that we can relate to other human beings, especially those whose values and convictions may be very different from our own, with care, kindness, patience, and compassion. So I want to bring this back to the Passionist Charism. I think the Passionist Charism tells us that we are called to move from a vision of fantasy to seeing the world through the eyes of Christ. In number 33 of the Passionist Constitutions, it says, "Christ loved everyone without exception." That's a sentence that's worth stopping over and pondering. Christ loved everyone, no matter who they were, without exception. But if we act according to how we see, Christ loved everyone without exception because Christ saw every single human being precisely in their differences as they truly were, a beloved, cherished child of God who reveals the extravagant love and goodness of God. That's what it means to see with the eyes of Christ, to see every single human being precisely in their differences as they truly are, a beloved, cherished child of God who reveals the extravagant love and goodness of God. Now, how can we grow in that moral and spiritual vision? A book I read many, many years ago that stayed with me might help us. The book is called Gift and Call by the Irish moral theologian Enda McDonagh. In that book, McDonagh says the moral life begins not with when we're given a list of laws and rules to follow, but rather McDonagh says the moral life begins when we stand in the presence of another person, no matter who that person is. The very presence of that person not only demands our attention, but constitutes a call to come out of ourselves by recognizing, respecting, and responding to the other. For McDonough, that's where the moral life begins. To be human is to be continuously called out of ourselves and into relationship with others. It is to move from isolation to communion through love. But whether or not we can do that all depends on how we see the other person, how we see other persons or groups or communities. The challenge, McDonough says, is to see the other person as a gift embodying a call to move out of ourselves and into relationship. When I see another person as a gift, I want to answer that call. I want to enlarge my world by welcoming them into it. However, all too often, instead of seeing another person, particularly in their differences, as a gift, McDonough says we see them as a threat. At the root of so much of the division and polarization today is a growing inability or unwillingness to see other persons, groups, or communities precisely in their differences as gifts summoning us out of ourselves in love. Instead, we've settled into a posture of threat rather than gift. Instead, we've allowed threat and fear to prevail. We've allowed threat and fear literally to get the best of us. McDonough suggests that the human call is to allow the gift to triumph over the threat through a love that welcomes differences. Now, he doesn't deny that this is easy, because all of us are a mix of both gift and threat. But he does insist that we must work to allow gift to triumph over threat, because unless we do, life together is impossible. That's whether we are talking about life together in our families, in marriages and partnerships, in friendships, in communities, in our parishes, in the church, and in the larger world. Passionists have something special here to contribute. The cross of Christ is a vivid reminder that human beings received God's message of love and fullness of life, not as a gift, but as a threat. That's odd. Jesus came into our world with a message of love and fullness of life, and we were afraid of it. We saw it not as a gift, but as a threat. Christ was crucified because Christ's message of the reign of God, his vision of a social order characterized by justice, love, equality, and community, was so threatening that it had to be silenced. And yet, the cross also reveals that God refused to let our refusal of the gift triumph. The cross tells us that no matter how hard we try, gift triumphs over threat. Communion wins out over fragmentation, and love and belonging over violence and exclusion. That is the message of hope that we are called to live and proclaim, a message that should be witnessed throughout the Passionist family and in all of our ministries. One way to deepen our capacity to do so is by practicing the virtue of respect. So this is the third virtue. We've had gentleness and humility. So now respect. We will grow in our ability to allow gift to triumph over threat as we cultivate the virtue of respect. Now, respect literally means to look again or to take a second look. Respect is a kind of patience, because to respect another person is to take whatever time is necessary for the unique image of God that lives in them, within them, to be revealed. We take as long as it takes until that unique image of God that is that other person is revealed. When we respect another person, we do not settle for first impressions. We don't casually dismiss them. We don't easily categorize them. Rather, we welcome them, we encounter, and we engage. In the Joy of the Gospel, Pope Francis said something that I think reveals the power and beauty of respect. Pope Francis says, whenever we encounter another person in love, we learn something new about God. That would help us create community and put an end to war and division if that was our moral stance in life. Whenever we encounter another person in love, we learn something new about God. That's respect. Respect transforms our way of seeing so that we view every opportunity to encounter another human being as an opportunity to learn something about God that only they can teach us. That would make a profound difference, to see every opportunity to encounter another human being as an opportunity to learn something about God that only they can teach us. So finally, I want to conclude this evening by just briefly sharing an insight on the importance of learning to befriend. Now, by talking about learning to befriend, I'm not saying that we can be close friends with everyone, but I am saying we can have goodwill toward everyone, and we can do what we can to make things better for them. The two fundamental qualities of friendship are benevolence and beneficence. Benevolence means to be of goodwill towards another person, to desire their good. It's the fundamental attitude of friendship. Beneficence means to do good for another. It's the fundamental activity of friendship. There's no reason that we cannot extend goodwill to every person. There's no reason we cannot do what we can to make things better for them. I think part of the problem today is that there's a diminishing lack of goodwill. There's a diminishing lack of goodwill towards other people. Again, we cannot be close friends with everyone, but we can treat them kindly. We can assume the best of them. We can be open and charitable and hospitable to them. And we can affirm their humanity and their dignity in how we look at them, speak to them, and treat them. As Gary Chartier says, at the very least, we ordinarily can and should indeed be friendly. The very least, we can and should indeed be friendly. We can be disposed to like one another and to wish each other well. So I want to end tonight with a closing sentence from the Jesuit Sam Sawyer's article that was the reading for tonight's session. His article, Catholicism, Authentic Communion, and the Way Out of Our Polarization Trap. In the very end of that article, Sam Sawyer says, there is a way out of this trap, and it starts by choosing to love those we are tempted to view as enemies. We always have that choice. The way out of this trap is by starting to choose everyone, including those we are tempted to love as enemies. It reminds me of a line in Tolstoy's novel, War and Peace, where Tolstoy says, if we look for reasons to love someone, we will never love them. If we love them, we will discover the reasons. I think that's the fundamental stance towards overcoming, dealing difference, and overcoming discord. Tolstoy is saying, lead with love. That's what Christ did. If we lead with love, community is possible. So thank you. I know that's a lot to share. I hope it was helpful. And I look forward to your discussions and also any questions, your comments you might have later tonight.
Thank you, Paul. We're going to take a brief break right now, about 5 minutes. So I welcome you to come back at about... well, it would be 5:32 here on the West Coast. But 5 minute break, then we'll go into breakout rooms. We'll have some time to discuss questions that Paul has sent us. And then we'll have a large group. And I'll put those questions in the chat and also on the screen while we're waiting. Here they come. Well, welcome back, everyone. What we'd like to do now is have a discussion for about 20 minutes with Paul. And what I'd like to invite you to do is at the bottom of your screen, or if you're using a phone, you may have to tap to see this. There's a reactions button. And if you click that, not the hands at the top, not the little icons, down at the bottom, it says raise hand. And if you use that, if you click on that, that is persistent. It doesn't go away until I've called on you, and then it'll go down. So if you just click one of the other ones, it'll go away after a few seconds. So go ahead and click that if you have a question, you'd like to say something. Kathy, go ahead and unmute. Or let's see.
I wasn't clicking to make a statement. I was just like, when you're telling me they're going to raise the hand.
To see what would happen, huh?
But Father God and I shared a good conversation. We're both part of the Passionist family over at Holy Name, the CPP group, and we're meeting Saturday. And so we were discussing, so much. Why don't the Father John take it for you? He was talking, I was listening and getting some good ideas, Yeah.
Just to say real quick to follow up what she said, just the idea of even joining the Passions for me was a kind of dealing with differences.
Yeah.
My part of the world I came from, to the Passionists, I was exposed to all sorts of different cultures and personalities and the traditions and things, and we made it, which has been great. So anyway, simple.
Thank you, John. Robin.
Thanks so much for a great talk. It was really inspiring. Yes. It was great to hear tonight.
Yes.
I just was thinking, when you're talking about gentleness, the famous verse from Francis de Sales, there's nothing so strong as gentleness, nothing so gentle as real strength. Mm-hmm. Kind of was encapsulates what you were saying, I think.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Thanks, Robin. I mean, it's interesting. People who know me know that I'm a fan of Aquinas, in the sense that if I'm never sure what to say, I just open up the Summa, because honestly, it has this reputation of being this really abstract theoretical book, but so much of it deals with this ordinary life. And I never thought about gentleness before until I read it, when he deals with gentleness in response to anger. And it made me think of to maybe reconceptualize our understanding of gentleness, because a lot of times we see it as a weakness, or we have a gentle person, we think somebody who never speaks up. But as you were saying, Robin, with that quote, I think like any virtue, gentleness is a power. And I could think of it, and I've seen that, I think, exhibited in the Passionist, where this gentleness is an openness to others. So many key people come to mind, but I would love to see it. And I was serious when I said I would love to see a retreat talk on gentleness, part of a mission or in parishes, along with a list of a lot of other, I think, unsung and forgotten virtues that are far more important than we think. But I just think today, we sorely need people who are witness gentleness and the difference it makes to bringing people for healing and for bringing people together.
Pat? Is
Thank
that?
you. I can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Paul, I really got a lot out of what you shared, especially these unsung virtues. Recently, I heard a quote, and I've been using it as I'm prone to do. Once I get one little gem, I tend to throw it everywhere I can. But it's been in homilies and sermons and now in my retreat talk. But it comes from, it's an un another, I think, undiscovered or un kind of overlooked virtue, and that is the kindness. And I heard this wonderful quote from the guy who is known here fondly as the voice of the Tigers. His name is Ernie Harwell. And I think he's quoting another author. But he said, I've come to a point in my life where I've discovered that it's more important to be kind than to be right. And I think at the heart of a lot of what's going on, we have a lot of people who have to be right. It's power, it's control, it's kind of self-security. But when you can learn that it's not helpful at all just to be right, it's more important to be kind. And that's something I want to spend a lot more time thinking about, along with the other virtues you recommended too. So thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, I'm glad you said that, Pat, because I mean, at least as I get older, especially as I look back over my life, what I remember most is exactly what you're talking about. People who, acts of kindness that came exactly at the moment I needed it. And what I've often found that happens is that if I would ever tell the person, you remember when you did this to me that made the world of a difference? More often than not, they don't remember. But if you receive the kindness, you'll never forget it. And again, I think it what you're saying gets to this idea that virtues are powers. If we just gentleness and kindness, we can think, well, those are almost like throwaway actions. But any virtues, they're powers that enable us to live well together. So I think it's so important. I mean, we should never be so busy that we don't have time to be kind. So it's yeah, no, it's great. And just the mention of Aquinas again, when he talks about kindness, he said, a person of kindness is poised to act kindly. So they're on the lookout to be kind. They're not waiting for the moment, they're anticipating opportunities to be kind. So I think you're absolutely right on that.
Jack?
Yeah, Paul, I also appreciate very much your words. I'm beginning to see an overlap, with Laudato Si and some other things where if I'm gentle with creation, I'm going to be gentle with people. If I remember the summer that we were in Japan, I was teaching in the YMCA, and I had a stack of test papers, and I kind of threw them on the desk. And in Japanese culture, it's a very disrespectful thing to do because the paper kind of mirrors that person. And so I think the way that we handle papers or close doors and all of that is related. And
Yeah.
if I do it harshly or aggressively, then it's going to come out in the ways that I deal with creation and other people.
Yeah, I think that's right, Jack. And one of the things I appreciate about Pope Francis, I mean, in all of his writings, but you see it in Laudato Si, is that stress that everything's connected. And we can't compartmentalize our lives because we're creatures of habits. So if I'm going to be thoughtless and unkind in certain areas of my life, it's going to carry over in others. And I mean, that's the whole point of the virtues, that their habits. But we, I think too often we can fool ourselves to thinking like, well, it's okay to let it go this time, you know, but that forms our character. So I think you're right. And it's the little things. It's, you know, how do you interact with people? This is a really small example, but I went to the dentist this morning, which is never my favorite thing to do because I'm extremely nervous when I go to the dentist. But at the end of this procedure, I thanked the dentist because I was surprised it was relatively painless. I was grateful for that. But he bowed to me twice. And, you know, and I asked him, I said, well, where are you from? I thought maybe he was from Japan or Korea. But he said he was from Hawaii. But twice he did that. And it was just great. You know, it's like you say, it was a little thing, but that'll stay with me. You know, that sense of kindness and gratitude.
Jim?
Yeah. Thanks, Paul. It was really a great talk. I appreciate it. You know, I was thinking this is in response, I guess, to that, the first question, how did we get to where we are? In our society, in our church. I was just thinking this past week, and maybe it's because of all the political stuff, that somehow within the past few years, somebody said, it's okay to hate other people. Mm-hmm. It's okay to say bad things about people. And you know, years ago, it was not okay. And the alternative to that is all the stuff you're talking about. It's not okay to hate. Mm-hmm. Not okay to be mean, and in fact, the only way we can get out of this is to be kind to other people. And you know, you wonder where we're going to go. It has to start somewhere. I mean, somebody has to turn it around and begin to say you can't do that anymore. You can't hate people.
Yeah, and I think what's so worrisome, Jim, is that once it becomes socially and culturally acceptable to hate, you know, to denigrate, then it becomes second nature. It becomes part of a culture. And the very things that we should worry about, we grow accustomed to. And, you know, hatred is poison. You know, it not only is toxic for the person I hate, but it also is poison to my own soul and spirit. And I think in some ways, we have to recover some traditional language and maybe use it in a different way. But there's a theologian, James Keenan of Boston College, who basically says to sin is not bothering to love. Mm-hmm. You know, I have the chance to do it and I just don't do it. It's not bothering to love. But once that becomes acceptable, then it's much easier to say, well, not only don't bother to love, but it's okay for me to hate you. You know, but then that spreads. So one of the things I wanted to say tonight, I think there's a power in a community and a family like the Passionist family to turn things around. I think, you know, the power of the witness of Passionist family and how we interact in our ministries to get the message out. And when you do that, you know, people can hear something and hopefully something connects with them.
Alex. You're muted, Alex.
Yeah, Paul, I really appreciated your presentation. A compliment to that is all the notes I took. So thank you so much. The first thing I wanted to share, I see a relationship between this attitude towards kindness as our attitude toward race, where we have to be proactive in terms of, you know, anti-racism. And I think we have to be proactive in terms of kindness, I mean, going out of our way and acknowledging when we see it happening. So I think folks sometimes don't realize the power of their presence and what they are able to accomplish just by how they are in public. Mm-hmm. The second thing I wanted to ask you, what does Samuel Wells write? Do you know any titles of his books?
Yeah, I could, if you send me your email, Alex, I could send that to you. What I mentioned tonight, he writes a column typically in every other issue of Christian Century, with the monthly magazine Christian Century. But he's great. I always read him because he'll make me think of things in a different way. He's the pastor of St. Martin in the Fields over in London, but is also quite a terrific writer.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead and unmute.
Okay, yeah, when you called on the other Jack, I came out of my reverie. So, hi, everybody. This is really special because it takes a lifetime to learn how to communicate and speak, and especially to listen. It takes a lifetime for most people to see what's behind a person's face and life and the like. And you're lucky when you're in a group that has this kind of charism. I've experienced this personally in the last couple of years working with the Passionists. Suddenly, waves of gentleness and humility and respect just suddenly become part of your life. It's been over a couple of years, and it's been regular, and it's been in small groups. And I just feel sorry for most of the world that gets onto their careers in their adulthood, and somehow all that there aren't groups like us, and it's really lovely. I'll turn it back to you. The best line in there is when you came up with the quote about morality is in the presence. It begins with your thoughts about it in the presence of another person, but not only in the presence of, but in the present. And what I got from this is a short little list to ask, because I've been through so many little things with my family and friends lately. All right, am I listening? Am I being gentle? Am I being kind? Am I being respectful? And is this person a gift? Of course, you realize, don't you, that the rest of us from now on, we're going to introduce ourselves and say, hi, I'm Jack, and I'm a gift. Anyway, that's it.
Well, I like that. That's a good strategy.
Joseph, go ahead and unmute.
Hi, everybody. Thanks, Paul. It's the classic Waddell lecture, which is excellent. And I've always remember you focus on the virtues. And it really is an art to do this, because some situations may call for humility and some may call, as Alex brought to our attention, maybe we're called to challenge things like racism and so forth, to speak out. So it's really an art. It's a dance. Often we go through life and there's no chance to practice this in the sense of prepare for it, because we're going to be throwing curveballs right and left. You know, they're going to come at us. Situations are going to arise suddenly. And then which virtue do we call upon? Anyway, can you speak to the whole thing about clustering virtues together?
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Joe. I mean, first of all, just briefly, traditionally, the whole idea is like all the virtues are interconnected. And that's exactly to your question, that as soon as you start talking about one, it's going to lead you to the other. So, I mean, for example, you know, if humility is clarity of vision, humility should help us see when it's time to speak out. But that's not easy. So we need the virtue of courage. And in order to speak out effectively, we need the virtue of prudence. So it kind of, I mean, that's to your, the virtues are clustered together. Now, it may be at certain times of our life, some virtues are going to be more prominent than others, but really you need all of them, you know, and that's why, I mean, I think you know, I only focused on three tonight, but you need all of them. I mean, and I think we should never think humility is not quietude. I mean, a humble person is not somebody who's standing, you know, meek and on the sidelines. I think Jesus was humble, but he was also prophetic. You know, he knew his mission. And so I think your question is really important, is once you dive into any virtue, it's going to lead you to another one, because they are clustered. And, you know, love informs all the virtues. It's the foundation of virtue. But even with that, you know, we need prudence to know how to love well. We need courage at times. We need forgiveness to keep love alive. We need fidelity. So you can, I mean, we're about to end, but if you get me going, I mean, it's like, you know, there's a whole litany of virtues. And I think, but that's the richness of it, I think. You know, I mean, the virtues, I think, are a much richer way to approach morality than through the language of law.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. You've always kept that insight alive through all your years. So thank you very much. All your many years. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
John. Talib?
Yes. Yes.
Can I just, it's 8:00. If people have to take off, disconnect, feel free to do so. But I wanted to ask Paul if he has a few more minutes to stay with us.
Okay.
I think there's another.
Carl, I could stay a few more minutes. Yeah, sure.
Okay. All right. So, Carl.
Thank you, Paul. You're like a wine. You get better with age. What I wanted to comment on, and I commented in my small group, was that I've been watching this synod as best I can. There's kind of a cap or moratorium on substance of their deliberations. What I notice is that they chose a format of sitting around tables with like 8 or 10 people and emphasizing listening. And I think to myself, my God, we did this stuff 50 years ago, and we've been doing it ever since. We have really developed a lot of skills. You know, I think when it comes to listening and gentleness, and by trial and error, we know what works and what doesn't. You know, and it's interesting that any number of these bishops that are there are threatened by this business. Yeah. As we're still trying to bring him kicking and screaming into the present age. I would bet a lot of those 40 women that are there have already done this stuff, and they're practicing a lot of patience with some of the men. Yeah. So anyway, just an interesting observation about the synod.
Well, I think you're right, Carl. I mean, there's something about looking face to face, you know, and when you're at a round table, you have to do that, you know, and I think that's part of what Enda McDonough is saying. When you're in the presence of another person, it calls, you know, for recognition, respect, and response. It calls for your attentiveness. And, you know, Pope Francis has said that in so many ways with his emphasis on encounter. But I also want to just, you know, echo what you said. I think one of the reasons I started my reflections tonight with the Passionist Charism is that I really hope we can appreciate the power and significance of the Passionist Charism in relation to this issue. It's not marginal. And I think, you know, to what you're saying, Carl, that Passionists, I think people, you know, the people feel welcome at retreat centers, parishes, just with Passionists, people in ministry or any kind of personal encounter, because I think that word of the cross is a word that moves towards wholeness. And there's a hunger for that. I mean, that's, and so I guess my hope tonight is maybe to see this as an opportunity to kind of reflect on the power and contemporary relevance of the Passionist Charism to address so many issues. And I mean, I just kind of combed through the Passionist Constitutions, and when you do that, certain things just jump out to you. I mean, it's like a pretty good handbook for helping us figure out how to address some of these some of these issues. But I think the passionist should know that, you know, so many of the things I talked about, gentleness, humility, and, you know, Pat, your mention on kindness, I think at their best, that's what passionists embody.
All right. Well, thank you, Paul. Thank you, everyone, for showing up. And again, we apologize for the little glitch with the portal. Hopefully that'll be up very soon. Don, do you have any final words? You're muted.
I, too, also wanted to thank Paul for a timely presentation. I think there's so much in it. I'll be busy the next few days kind of unwrapping everything for myself. So I appreciate that, Paul. And then just a reminder, there's no gathering in December, but our next time together will be January 11th, and that's going to be on the gift and grace of God's compassion by Virginia Blass, who's a preacher out in the Eastern Province with some of their retreat houses. So we can look forward to that. So, okay. So thank you, everyone. Hope you have a great Thanksgiving.
Yes. And you too, Paul.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Paul. Okay.
Thanks.
Great job, Paul. Great job.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Did Loretta get out of here? Oh, happy birthday, Loretta.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Had I known, I'd have sent you an off-color card or something.
That's a good note. Okay. Oh, wonderful. Good laugh. And with a laugh.
Oh. Big Al.
Bye.
Call me.